Tomorrow afternoon from 4 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
And now, tonight's Drama on 3, Different Truths, a double bill of short works by European author and dramatist Friedrich Dürrenmatt. A Conversation at Night, starring Jim Broadbent and Ian McDermott, is followed by An Incident at Twilight, starring Ian McDermott and Michael Moreland. But first, we begin with an introduction by Ian McDermott.
Dürrenmatt himself, he was born in the early 20s in Switzerland. His dad was a Protestant minister, although he himself later on became not to be a man of faith, not a Christian, I guess an atheist. He was politically active from an early age, of the left. He was an admirer of Bertolt Brecht, but he didn't go as far as Brecht. He didn't believe, as Brecht did, that people ought to be reminded that they're in a theatre the whole time. He had a more seductive approach, and he did believe in empathy and drawing people in. And he did it by means of what we would now call the absurdist school. I mean, he was a bit before the absurdist school. But he liked to mix things up, a mixture of comedy, satire, moral confusion, really, ambiguities and contradictions, which in my mind is always a sign of a good playwright. Keeps you on your toes, keeps you thinking and questioning all the time. And these two plays are a very good example of that. He wasn't terribly well known to me. I think that's probably true of most people. He hasn't made his mark in the European canon the way, you know, distinguished writers like Beckett and Ionesco have, for example. Most people, if they know him at all, will know him through The Visit, which is quite often performed, not least because it has a wonderful part for a woman of middle age, usually. And I've seen Catherine Hunter play it, Leslie Manville, and I believe Lauren Bacall played it many years back at Chichester. So it has quite a pedigree. And then there was the physicist at the RSC a good few years ago at the Aldwych. But these two plays were new to me when the BBC suggested I have a look at them. So I did what I could to sharpen them and make them more actor-friendly for contemporary actors. He approaches things from a humorous point of view largely, but there are always dark undertones, and in the case of one of these plays, particularly dark undertones. They're both about truth and people's version of the truth, and as we know, there are no versions of the truth, there's only the truth. And that struck me as immediately pertinent, because people are always either distorting it, faking it, or claiming it for their own. I think the cliche I hate most is when someone announces my truth. You think, well, it's not yours. It's not the truth if it's yours. The truth is a universal. And the play is about that, both of them, really, in their different ways. In Conversations at Night, the regime is an authoritarian one where the truth is a subset of power, really. And if you speak it, you're liable to be arrested. Unless you conform to the prevailing lies, you're unlikely to be living a profitable existence. And I don't need to say to people what the resonance of that can be. And then the second play, there is the relationship between truth and fiction, I think, really, because the main character, they're both writers, both of the leading characters in the plays, and this one is an author who writes novels and thrillers, really, as did Dürrenmatt himself. And the interesting thing about those is they're based on truth. Now, that's not particularly interesting in itself, but as they're all about murderers, the murderer is, and I won't give anything away, is revealed in the course of the action in a surprising way, which draws attention to another kind of truth.
Different Truths by Friedrich Dürrenmatt in versions for radio by Ian McDermott. A Conversation at Night.
The following following statement has just been released by the Prime Minister's office. Let there be no mistake. This man is a danger to the community. His writings and speeches have attacked the Senate. His words have been a calculated affront to the nation, a dangerous attempt to undermine the stability of the country. I say to you that this interference with a government elected freely by the people is unjustifiable and will not be tolerated. Therefore, I have ordered his house arrest. This is the first step in preventing these reactionaries, of whom he is a typical example, from disseminating lies and false information, from sowing the seeds of discontent, and thereby spreading unrest in these difficult and challenging times.
Please, come in. Come in. No sense in sitting on the window ledge, now you've already climbed this far. Anyway, I can see you. It's dark, but it's lighter than the darkness in this room. Oh, you've dropped your torch. I'll turn on the light.
Thank you.
Well, there you are then. The situation immediately becomes less tense. Now we can see one another. You're older than I expected.
You thought I'd be some fiery youth.
I did, as it happens. Your torch is down there by the chair.
And now I've smashed your Chinese vase.
Greek amphora.
It's in pieces, I'm sorry.
Well, it looks as if I shan't have much opportunity of missing it.
It really shouldn't be part of my job to climb up the side of apartment buildings. The things they ask you to do nowadays. I'm sorry to have been so clumsy.
These things happen. You assumed I would be asleep in the bedroom. You couldn't have known that I would still be at my desk in the pitch dark in the middle of the night.
When normal people are in bed.
In normal times.
And your wife?
You need have no concerns on her account.
Why's that?
She's dead.
Do you have children?
I thought you would have been better informed. My only son is in a concentration camp. Or so I've been given to understand.
I've never seen so many books.
I am a writer.
Do people read what you write?
My books are read wherever they are forbidden.
And where they are not?
They are reviled, mostly.
Do you employ a secretary?
I see you have no conception of the sort of money a writer makes.
So there is no one else in the apartment?
I am quite alone.
Absolute quiet is required. You must understand that.
Of course.
It is sensible of you not to make difficulties for me.
You have come to kill me.
That is my profession.
You murder for money.
It's my trade. I have been this country's executioner for the last 50 years.
I see.
So you were expecting someone else?
I have no expectations.
Well, you seem to be handling the situation with considerable self-control.
And you express yourself with remarkable precision.
I read a lot. And my work these days is mainly concerned with educated people.
Won't you sit down?
I'll station myself by the desk, if you don't mind.
Make yourself at home. May I offer you a drink?
Afterwards, perhaps. I need to keep my hand steady.
Then, obviously, you'll have to help yourself. I bought it specially for you.
You knew you had been sentenced to death?
I assume so. That's the fate of everything in this country. Everything has been condemned one way or another, so there's nothing for a man to do but stare out of the window, up at the sky, and wait.
For death?
For the assassin. In our benighted country, everything is a matter of calculation. You know, things follow their logical course with an unerring regularity. The Prime Minister attacked me. One knows what that implies. His Excellency's speeches are in the habit of producing anaesthetic consequences. And all my friends started to withdraw, realising that calling on me would automatically trigger a death sentence for them. The state confined me within the walls of this apartment, and sooner or later it was obvious that someone would be sent to dispatch me. This man I have been waiting for. Someone who thinks as they do. I looked forward to telling this emissary of death what I've spent my whole life fighting. I wanted to show him that a free spirit need not show fear. And now you have come.
The state executioner.
With whom any conversation is surely pointless.
You despise me.
I'm simply stating the logical position.
And you would have shown more respect to some common assassin?
I would have treated him like a brother. Fought with him like a brother. A spirited defence might have overwhelmed him, but it is a state functionary who has come through my window. A civil servant who will receive a pension for his killing and will go home and fall asleep on the sofa, sated like a spider. I embarrass you.
Not at all.
Of course, the professional killer is not required to react. How do you propose to perform the deed?
I have a knife.
A surgical procedure. Will it be painful?
Over in seconds.
Have you killed many people in this way?
A fair number.
Well, I'm grateful the state at least sends an expert and not a beginner. Is there anything I have to do?
If you'd be so good as to undo your collar.
Really? May I at least have a last cigarette?
Of course. Everyone is granted that as a matter of principle. There's no rush.
Yeah. Will you have one?
Afterwards.
Of course. Everything afterwards. I'll leave them by the brandy.
Most kind.
There. Now my collar is open. One button enough.
Two, please. Sorry about that.
Are you indeed? Then we can both agree this is a regrettable situation.
Actually, you're one of the lucky ones. At night, in private.
A special case.
You're a writer. A supporter of free speech.
They tell you that much.
They're all for freedom, the ones I have to kill.
And what does the state executioner know about freedom?
Next to nothing. You stubbed out your cigarette.
Yes, I'm a little nervous.
Would you like to die now?
Perhaps another cigarette, if I may.
Please. Most of them smoke one more and then one more. Used to be French or Russian. Now it's American or English.
I can imagine. A couple of cigarettes before dying and a chat with you. I wouldn't want to forgo that.
Even though you despise me.
One gets used even to what one despises. Sure sign it's high time you were dead. Thank you.
Everyone exhibits at least a touch of fear.
Yes, just a touch.
A man does not willingly give up his life.
Well, when justice is no longer available, it's less of a problem. But then justice is not something you concern yourself with.
Justice is for those of you on the outside. You people are always offered an alternative. You see, that was never on offer to me. I've lived for 50 years in prison. It's only lately they've taken to sending me out, and then only at night. Now and then I turn on the radio to get a sense of who's in, who's out, who's on the way up, who's for the chop. The ever-flowing current of destiny, the demise of the mighty, the mute surrender of the weak. But where I am, everything stays the same. The same grey walls, the same damp running down them, the mouldy patch on the ceiling you could mistake for the map of Europe. The daily walk down the long, dark corridor into the courtyard. In the grey light of dawn. Always the same pale figures in their grimy shirts and trousers, the same faces, white with fear, as they're led towards me. That sudden hesitation as they first catch sight of me. the same dull thud as I dispatch, guilty and innocent alike.
Fascinating. Tell me, what is the most important thing to an executioner?
I suppose the way a man faces his final moments. What you might call the art of dying.
Mm. Well, it seems to be the only art worth mastering these days.
I wonder if it's possible to teach this art. Perhaps it's impossible to learn. I see only that some have it and some do not. But I know nothing about these people before they come to me. What they get up to before they're ushered into the presence of death. I often wonder what their lives must be like. What it means to be married, to have children, to work to support their families, handling machines, driving a plough, going in for politics, drinking, gambling, sacrificing themselves for ideas, striving for power or being crushed by it. Whether they're exceptional or just run-of-the-mill, what their background is, their religion, the money or the lack of it that shapes their lives. The hunger that forces them to make something of themselves. You see, I don't know the truth about human beings. I only know what the truth is for me.
And what is the hangman's truth?
At first, I imagined it was fairly simple. I was no more than a stupid brute with a powerful job. But life has taught me that the only thing that really matters is life itself. Living. Being alive. That was how I came to be an executioner those 50 long years ago. I was a wild animal. A born criminal, you might say, up before the court. It was that same court that let me keep my life in exchange for becoming a public servant. The hard-working hangman. A steady job. I became an executioner as a man on the outside might become a baker or a soldier, to earn a wage, to stay alive. That was my reasoning. That was my aim. Do you understand that?
Absolutely.
And I had quite an instinct for it. It seemed natural that a man should defend himself as he came face to face with me, that a furious struggle might erupt between us until I had his head on the block or the noose around his neck. I understood that fury, that passion, because that was how I grew up, a wild, desperate lad from the forest who might stick a knife in someone in the grip of a sudden burst of anger, or commit a savage robbery just to eat, or to get enough money to impress a girl. I recognised myself in them. I was one of them. The reckoning was clear cut. They faced up to their punishment. And then there were the others, who looked right past me and treated me with contempt. They mocked the government, made fine speeches about freedom and justice, believing that right was on their side. They showed an indifference to death. Once again, the reckoning was clear. There was a war between them and me. They died hugging their sense of justified anger, righteous in their contempt. I felt the same as I struck them down. Justice for both of us. Their deaths left a mark.
A valiant way to die.
They don't die like that anymore.
What do you mean?
Under earlier governments, every execution was an event, an occasion to be remembered. The judge, the prosecutor, the defence counsel, reporters, doctors, all in black. Sometimes there was even a drum roll, a setting worthy of a fiery speech of denunciation. Not anymore. Now they die alone with me. No point in making speeches, not even a priest to hear their last words. And because they despise me, they find they have nothing to say. And that's not right. The reckoning is not even between us. The condemned are getting short measure. So they die like animals in a state of indifference. And even in the rare instance when, from time to time, the state finds it necessary to have a trial, even when a judge and the public prosecutor actually put in an appearance, the condemned man is now a broken vessel who hopelessly submits to whatever is done to him. A wretched death. Times have changed.
Times have changed indeed, when even the hangman realizes it. I had hoped for a sort of martyr's end, but I too am here, alone with you, waiting for death like some helpless animal.
There is another way.
What other way?
To die with humility.
Humility? The wisdom of the executioner. Die with humility? That's grotesque. One should protest against the crimes committed against humanity with one's last breath.
Protests are the business of the living. The dying have more pressing obligations.
The obligations of the dying and the living are one and the same. Look, here I am, in my room at night, with only my books for company, without charge, without a trial, without even receiving a sentence, waiting to be killed in secret by a man worthy only of contempt, and you ask for humility? The shamefulness of an age that makes statesmen of murderers and judges of hangmen, that forces someone who only seeks the truth to end his life like a common criminal. Criminals fight, you say. Well, I shall fight you with my last breath.
As you wish, although there will be little point.
The fight with the hangman is the one fight left that has some meaning. My death will not disappear unrecorded without a murmur. My struggle will be heard. Listen to me. There's a man in here fighting with his executioner. An innocent man is being killed in here like an animal. Come out and see the kind of country you're living in. Aren't you going to stop me?
No.
I'll shout again.
No.
Aren't you going to fight with me?
The fight will begin when I pinion you with my arms.
Help!
No one has come. Give another shout. Every night someone shouts into the streets, but no one comes. Why don't you sit down and have a brandy? Does you good when you're getting ready for a fight.
There, you pig.
You're at the end of your tether. If you really want to fight with me, by all means, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that.
It's understandable.
It seems nothing disturbs your self-control.
I'm not the one dying tonight.
No, the hangman always stays alive. Throughout my life, I fought with weapons deemed worthy of a man, the weapons of the intellect. I was Don Quixote questing after an evil beast, armed with only a respectable prose style. What a farce. Now I'm confronted by a killer in my own home, and I don't even have a toy gun hidden under my pillow for protection. May I have another cigarette?
Here, let me light it for you.
Just this one, then I shan't trouble you any more. I appear to have surrendered myself to you.
In all humility?
What?
No one is more difficult to understand than the humble man. It takes a while even to recognise them. Like you, I would despise somebody like that at first. But then I came to recognise that in the great scheme of things, in the art of dying, they were the grand masters. You see, their capitulation is not one of exhaustion, nor is it out of fear. The humble have no fear. I could see that a criminal might be humble in the face of death, but I couldn't make out why this could also apply to an innocent man. when the time came for me to strike, I really hated myself. Yet they died with a composure that really puzzled me. An almost serene acceptance, as if their death was entirely justified. That seemed incomprehensible to me. It made a mockery of my office.
Once a man stands before his executioner, it makes little difference what pose he strikes. It's all over.
I can only tell you what I've learned from people who died as innocent men. I've not forgotten a single one of those deaths.
You must have a prodigious memory.
I think of little else.
And what did they teach you, the innocent and the humble?
The things I can overcome and the things I can't.
So your power has its limits. You're hesitating. Come on. You're one of the chosen few who's still permitted to put his philosophy into practice. Expound away. Let's hear it.
The power given to me, and which I exercise with these two hands, the soft noose that I lay about a neck, the lightning flash of the knife striking home in the depths of the night, is but a small part of that power which belongs to the oppressors of this world. All acts of violence resemble each other. My power mirrors that of the powerful. They kill through me. They above, I below. Their reasons range from the most elevated to the most vulgar. I have no reasons. I am the resting axle round which their terrible wheel revolves. In my blood-stained hands, their power attains its final decisive form, like pus forming in a boil. So here I am, standing opposite my victim, in the light of the lamp, at this desk, at night, clutching under my old worn coat, a knife. I am despised because shame has been taken from the great ones of this earth and laid upon my shoulders. Men fear me, but the men of power are not only feared, they are admired. Envied, they enjoy their treasures, for power seduces. And men love where they should hate. So it is that accomplices cling to their masters. Like dogs, they snap for crumbs that fall from the table. Those on top thrive on the abrogated power of those beneath, and vice versa. The shiny doors of the black convoy of terror open to reveal the ultimate executioner, whom men fear more than me. The tyrant who drives ever greater multitudes into the charnel houses, as one act of violence begets another. One tyranny gives rise to another, over and over, again and again, like the ever-descending circles of hell.
All right, enough.
You asked me to speak. Your body I can take. A body is subject to violence. But the things you have fought for, over these I have no power. They do not come to dust. That is what I, a hangman, a man despised, have learned from the uncomplaining innocents I have struck down and who did not seek to defend themselves. In the hour of their unjust death, to die like children, without cursing the world, is a victory greater than any won by the men of power. In their quiet resignation, in the accepting dignity of those humble souls as they approach their last moments, a sort of peace envelops them. It envelops me too, like a sustained prayer that contradicts reason itself. If men were merely flesh and blood, those in power would hold sway without question, with no one to oppose them. They would build their empires with impunity. But the bodies of the men they've killed are testament to a living reality, a remembrance of what is true, a truth which no torturer can defile, no prison enclose, and about which the despised executioner knows nothing, save that it exists. If men were merely flesh, it would be a simple matter for the men of power. They could construct their empires as one might build a wall, square foot by square foot, till all the world was stone. But however they build, however monumental their palaces, however devious their schemes or cunning their plots, in the bodies of those they dishonour lies the legacy of how the world might be. The remembrance of why God created man, the overpowering belief that this world must fragment, that his kingdom may come, and with such explosive force, a force mightier than the splitting of the atom, a force that will demolish the fortresses of power, releasing from the mountains the fast-flowing waters of renewal.
Platitudes. Nothing but platitudes.
Perhaps nowadays that's all we have. Another cigarette?
No.
Drink?
No. That's the first tram. Shut the window. I was planning to say something noble to my untutored young assassin when he arrived, and now the public executioner has expressed a few home truths to me. I fought against exploitation for a better life, that men should not perish in some knacker's yard or on some muddy field or even at your indifferent bloody hands. It was a fight for things we used to take for granted. It's a dark time when one has to fight for such things. It was a good fight, but it will be a worthy surrender. Nothing of what we did is lost. This fight will be taken up again somewhere, sometime, by somebody, possibly at any moment. In all humility. All right, hangman, switch off the lamp. The first light of day will guide your hand.
As you wish.
Take the knife now.
Are you comfortable in my arms?
Comfortable. Yes. Strike.
An Incident at Twilight by Friedrich Dürrematt.
I consider it my duty at the very outset to describe to you the setting of this possibly somewhat peculiar, but I assure you, entirely true story. To be sure, there is a considerable element of danger in telling true stories. Someone from the police or possibly even a high court judge might be among those listening. Nonetheless, I can allow myself to take that risk, because I know perfectly well they won't believe this true story, at least not in their official capacity. In reality, that is to say. So, imagine yourself in the drawing room of a suite at the Grand Hotel.
It's an honour to find myself in the presence of the world-famous author, Maximilian Frederick Corbus.
What are you doing in my room?
Your secretary let me in. I've been waiting over an hour.
Who are you?
My name is Hofer.
That sounds vaguely familiar. Oh, the fellow who's been bombarding me with letters.
Ever since you arrived here to take the waters. I've had a chat with the doorman every morning. Not that that did me much good. I finally managed to ambush your secretary, a very correct young man.
Sebastian, theology student, poor as a church mouse.
My unshakable persistence finally convinced him a meeting would be of the greatest significance for both of us.
Well, since you're nearer the drinks cabinet, you might just pass me the whiskey bottle.
Certainly.
Yes. Thank you. Care for one yourself?
I'd rather not.
Something else, perhaps?
No, thanks.
You a teetotaler?
No, just careful. I am, after all, in the presence of a literary giant. I feel a little like St. George before his encounter with the dragon.
Are you a Catholic?
Evangelical.
I'll need another drink.
You ought to look after yourself.
You could keep your advice to yourself.
I'm from Switzerland, Mr. Corbus. Do you mind if I take a closer look at the room in which the poet creates?
Writer.
Books and manuscripts, of course. And photographs. May I take a look at them? William Faulkner. Personally inscribed to my dear Corbus. Thomas Mann. To Corbus with admiration and respect. Ernest Hemingway, to Corbus, my best friend and soulmate. Only in love and murder do we remain sincere. Henry Miller. And look at this view. What a superb sight. The lake with the mountains behind it, the ever-changing clouds above it, and the sun just going down a glowing red. Most seductive.
You write too, eh?
I read. I know your complete works almost by heart.
Teacher?
Bookkeeper, retired.
Have a seat.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm a little wary of these contemporary chairs. A very impressive apartment.
They charge enough for it.
I can imagine. This is an expensive spa. Disastrous for my means, even though I live in the cheapest possible manor at the Sea View boarding house. Oh, it was cheaper in Adelboden.
Adelboden?
In Adelboden.
I was in Adelboden recently.
You were at the Grand Hotel there. I was in the hostel for retirees. Our paths have crossed several times. For example, at the ski lift in St. Moritz, and on the promenade in Baden-Baden.
You were in Baden-Baden too?
I was.
When I was there?
At the Salor Home for Christian Men.
Yeah, well, I have to manage my time pretty carefully. I have a lot of work to do, Mr...
Hofer?
Yeah, Mr. Hofer. I'm afraid I can only spare a quarter of an hour, so tell me what you want, and please make it brief.
I've come with a very definite purpose.
You want money, eh? Well, I have none to spare for any Tom, Dick or Harry who just happens along. The amount the Nobel Prize pays out is greatly exaggerated, so if you please, we'll say goodbye.
You misunderstand me. I didn't come to you because I need money, but because ever since I retired, I have been employed in detective work.
Oh, I see. Well, that's a different matter altogether. Please, take a seat. What a relief. Well then, so... You're employed by the police now.
I'm a private detective. Even when I was still a bookkeeper, there were all sorts of things that I uncovered. I was honorary auditor for several companies. I even succeeded in having the town treasurer of Ennetville near Hawk sent to jail for embezzling the orphanage funds. And so, when I had retired, and the savings of a lifetime were at my disposal, my wife having died childless, I made up my mind, under the influence of your books, to devote myself entirely to my hobby.
My books?
Your immortal books. They fired my imagination. I read them with feverish anticipation, totally overcome by the magnificence of the crimes you wrote about. I became a detective, rather in the way a religious person, inspired by the ingenious way in which the devil sets about his work, might become a priest.
What particular branch of criminology do you specialise in? Espionage? Divorce? Narcotics? White slave traffic?
Literature.
You're a critic.
If you would permit me to explain.
Get out.
But I've only analysed your works with respect to their criminological aspect.
Oh. I see. I have been interpreted from many standpoints. Psychoanalytic, Catholic, Protestant, existential, Buddhist, Marxist. But never from the one you have adopted.
I owe you an explanation. I read your works because of a certain theory I had formed. Whatever exists in a world of fiction must also exist in reality. It seems to me impossible to invent something which does not already exist.
Not a wholly unreasonable conclusion.
So I began to look in real life for the murders described in your novels.
You assumed that there was some sort of connection between my novels and reality.
Exactly. First, I subjected your works to a rigorous analysis. You are the most notorious and newsworthy writer of our time. A man whose divorces, love affairs, alcoholic excesses and tiger hunts are written up in all the newspapers and scandal sheets. You are also known as the creator of some of the most beautifully described murder scenes in world literature.
I've never glorified murder per se. I've always tried to show man as a whole. Part of that whole, of course, is the fact that he is capable of committing murder.
Speaking as a detective, I was not interested so much in what you tried to do as in what, in fact, you succeeded in doing. Before you, murder was universally considered to be something horrible, detestable. But you have managed to bring a magnificence, a certain beauty, in fact, to the dark side of life, or rather, death. Your heroes murder neither for profit, nor because of thwarted passion. They murder for psychological gratification, for pleasure, to display their skill or to increase their range of experience, motives not recognised by traditional criminological theory. You are quite literally too deep, too subtle for the police. As a result, they don't even suspect that a murder has been committed, since, as far as they are concerned, where there is no motive, there is no crime. If one assumes, then, that the murders you describe really took place, it follows that they must have appeared to the public to be accidents, suicides, or even deaths from natural causes.
That would be the natural conclusion.
Just as they appear to be to the people in your novels.
Exactly.
At this point in my investigations, it struck me I bore a marked resemblance to that Spanish knight, Don Quixote, whom you frequently mention in your novels. He sallied forth as he did because he took the knightly romances he encountered for reality. And I determined to take your novels for reality. But I did not let myself become put off by fear or trepidation. My motto has always been, onwards, though the world be riven with evil intent.
Marvellous. What you've undertaken is absolutely marvellous.
Sir?
Offer Mr. Hofer a cigar.
No, I'll smoke my own, if you don't mind.
A light, then. Thank you, Sebastian.
Sir?
Do go on with your story, Mr.
Hofer. Nothing I enjoy so much as a good smoke. First, I sifted through Rendezvous Abroad.
My first novel.
Published 11 years ago.
Subsequently, a movie by Alfred Hitchcock. Oh,
what an achievement. A French adventurer. Fat, tanned, unshaven, balding, dissipated, gifted, and a hard drinker. Meets a woman, the wife of a German diplomat. He entices her to go with him to a rundown hotel in Ankara. A filthy hellhole of the worst sort, where he seduces her. Then, his alcoholic haze inspiring him to Shakespearean heights, He convinces her that the greatest happiness lies in a suicide pact. Hypnotized by his passionate oratory, she kills herself in a bout of sexual ecstasy. He lights a cigarette and walks out. Then he takes a stroll through the slums, beats up a preacher of the Christian mission to the Turks, robs its poor box and makes off for Persia before dawn. Once there, he goes prospecting for oil. Possibly the Swiss Review of Books is right to call this a trivial plot. Nonetheless, it leaves Hemingway many leagues behind for brevity and concision.
You're not going to tell me that you took your investigations all the way to Turkey in order to verify the story?
I had no alternative. I went to considerable expense to obtain the Ankara newspapers for 1954, the year in which your novel takes place, and got a Turkish exchange student at the Federal Technological Institute to go through them for me.
And the result?
It was the wife of a Swedish diplomat rather than a German who committed suicide. A blonde beauty, somewhat reserved. She was found in a hotel of the lowest sort. No reason for the suicide was discovered. Precisely as I predicted.
And the man with whom she went to this hotel?
Unknown. The evidence of the desk clerk, however, indicates that we're dealing here with a German-speaking individual. I have also established that one of the preachers of the Christian mission to the Turks was indeed savagely beaten up. He was too badly injured to give any evidence about his assailant. After this, I examined Mr. X is Bored.
Churchill's favourite novel.
Your second book, a masterpiece. Mr. X, formerly a good-for-nothing, but now an established and popular writer, moderator of the American Pen Club, meets a 16-year-old girl in Saint-Tropez. He's enchanted by her beauty and simplicity. The intensity of nature, the reflection of the sea, the merciless sun, all combine to bring out his primitive instincts. The result? Rape and murder in the pouring rain of a tremendous thunderstorm. Surely the most beautiful and at the same time most repulsive pages ever written. The dialogue seems merely sketched out, but is actually extremely precise. Then there's the fascinating description of the police procedure, the motorcycles, the radio cars with their screaming sirens, the hunt for the killer, and the suspects, who seem to include everyone except the actual murderer. He's too famous and too admired to arouse the slightest suspicion. On the contrary, before he leaves for London in order to accept the Lord Byron Prize, Mr. X attends the funeral, with a description of which the book ends, like the denouement of a Greek tragedy.
Your powerful imagination is getting the better of you, my dear Hofer.
10 years ago in 1957, a 16-year-old English girl was raped and murdered in Saint-Tropez.
And the murderer?
Unknown.
Just like the murderer of the Swedish woman.
Exactly so. Despite an extremely efficient police force.
Exactly so.
The authorities don't have the slightest clue.
Did you make any further discoveries?
If you would be so good as to glance at this piece of paper. It's a list of all the people whose connection with characters in your novels I have established.
Let me see. 22 names on this list.
Precisely the number of novels you have written.
All of these people are dead.
Some of them committed suicide. Some of them died because of unexpected accidents. With the exception of the young English girl who was raped and murdered, of course.
Why is there a question mark next to the name of the Argentinian millionaires, Juana?
Oh, she corresponds to Mercedes, who is strangled by the hero of your novel, Evil Knights. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, however, the multimillionaireess died in Ostend of natural causes.
This is a very valuable list.
The result of 10 years' criminological investigation. And that isn't all. Whenever these accidents and suicides occurred, you, my dear sir, were present.
Is that a fact?
You were in Ankara when the Swedish woman died. You were in Saint-Tropez when the English girl died. You were in all the 20 other places when the 20 other people on that list died. I need only mention the parliamentary secretary, von Vattenwiel in Davos, Countess Windischgrätz in Biarritz, Lord Liverpool in Split.
Everyone on this list, in other words.
Everyone.
You've been on my track, eh, Mr. Hofer?
I had to follow your tracks if I was going to be a professional detective. From one resort to another. From one expensive spa to the next.
So you were not merely in Adelboden and Baden-Baden with me?
Wherever you were, I was there.
Wasn't that extremely expensive for you?
Ruinous. My means were extremely limited. My pension is laughably small. I had to economise. Some of my trips literally meant starvation for me. The only one I wasn't able to undertake was the one to South America 7 years ago. And, of course, your annual excursions to the African or Indian jungle.
Quite unnecessary. I only hunt tigers and elephants there.
At all other times, I stuck to you.
That's beginning to be abundantly clear.
And wherever we stayed, you in a 5-star hotel, me in a shabby rooming house, an accident, which you later wrote up as a murder, occurred.
My dear Hofer, you are the most remarkable man I have ever met.
The next question I was faced with, naturally, concerned the manner in which this correspondence between your works and reality had come about.
Naturally.
Two possibilities presented themselves to me after I had performed the necessary logical examination of the facts. Either you modelled your characters on people you had observed in real life, or your plots actually occurred in reality, precisely the way you described them.
Absolutely.
If we assume that the second theory is true, then your plots, which are universally admired as the products of your inexhaustible imagination, are nothing more nor less than factual accounts. I hesitated a long time before I permitted myself to subscribe to this theory, but now I know it's the only possible one. This brings up a new problem, however. If your novels are factual accounts, it follows that the murders you describe are also factual. And that brings us ineluctably to the question, who are the murderers?
And what have you discovered?
That we must look upon the various murderers as one murderer. All of your protagonists clearly possess characteristics common to one particular person. They're all powerful men with large bald heads, usually bare-chested, larger than life in their gestures. They rush through the baroque sea of your prose in a permanent state of semi-intoxication. You are the murderer.
In other words, you are saying that I have several times...
21 times.
22 times.
21 times. The Argentinian multimillionaireess constitutes an exception.
Yes, all right, all right. You're saying, in other words, that I have murdered almost 22 people.
That is my firm and immovable conviction. I am in the presence not only of one of the foremost writers, but also of one of the foremost murderers of all time.
22?
21.
21 times, then. When you hear a thing like that...
It makes you think.
Well, now, what is it you want from me?
Now that I've told you the results of my researches, I can breathe again. I have often trembled at the thought of this moment, but I have not been disappointed. I see you are calm and still amicably disposed to me. I would like to continue speaking with the same terrible frankness to you.
By all means.
At first, I only intended to hand you over to the forces of justice.
And have you changed your mind?
I have.
Why?
I have been observing you now for 10 years. I have seen how masterfully you have pursued your passion, how carefully you have chosen your victims, and how calmly and resignedly you have approached your work.
You admire me?
Immeasurably.
As a writer or as a murderer?
Both. The more I have discovered about your criminal activities, the more I have learned to value your literary finesse. I am ready and willing to make a supreme sacrifice to your art.
Namely?
I'm prepared to turn my back on the greatest thing that has happened to me in my life. I will sacrifice the fame and the glory that are my due.
So you've decided not to turn me in?
I renounce the opportunity.
And what do you expect in return?
A small token of appreciation.
In what form?
Well, you see, I'm bankrupt. I've sacrificed everything I own for my art. I'm no longer in a position to lead the kind of life I've become accustomed to while serving the cause of criminological science. I can't afford to roam from one expensive resort to another anymore. I shall be obliged to return to Ennetville near Hawk with a cloud over my head. My life in ruins unless...
Go on.
Unless you see fit to supplement my meagre pension with a little extra pocket money. Say, 600 or 700 Swiss francs per month, so that I can continue to play a part in your life. Oh, quite discreetly, of course, as your admirer and confidant.
My dear Mr. Hofer, I too would like to make a confession. I too would like to speak with terrible frankness, as you put it. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that you are the greatest detective I've ever met. Your criminological talents and your razor-sharp mind have not led you astray. You are perfectly right. I confess everything.
You admit it?
I admit it.
The Swedish woman?
The Swedish woman.
The young English girl?
Her too.
Countess Vindishgrate?
Likewise, the Argentinian multimillionaires as well.
I'm sorry, I cannot allow you that one.
But, my dear sir...
You know perfectly well that you're trying to cheat now.
All right, all right. We'll omit the multimillionaires.
And you did murder the 21 others.
All 21.
This is the culminating moment of my existence.
Quite. The culminating moment of your existence, in a somewhat different sense from the one you intended, however. Despite the accuracy of your conclusions, you have made one mistake, Mr. Hofer. Hasn't it occurred to you that it might be dangerous to come and tell me about your knowledge of my private life?
You mean you could kill me?
Precisely.
Well, naturally, that occurred to me. I've examined the situation from every angle and quietly and calmly taken every imaginable precaution. A well-known American movie star lives in the room above yours. A colonel in the English army on your left and a middle-class widow on your right.
A widow duchess, if you don't mind.
Not so. My investigations reveal that her husband was a department store doorman in Geneva. The room below yours is occupied by the tubercular Archbishop of Chernovitz. One cry for help from me and there'll be a scandal which will shake the world. So you'd have to kill me noiselessly. Poison would be your only way.
So that's why you wouldn't take a drink?
Exactly. And it wasn't very easy for me to refuse. I happen to have a particular fondness for good whiskey.
Nor would you smoke one of my cigars.
You got rid of the tenor Lorenz Hochstresser with a particularly mild Havana, impregnated with an Indian poison.
You forget one thing. You come from Ennetville near Hawk.
Don't underestimate the place. Ennetville near Hawk has an active cultural life.
That's what I mean. Nowadays, places that have an active cultural life are on the other side of the moon, as it were. Otherwise, you would have been aware of the senselessness of your investigations. You have merely proved something that didn't require proof.
You mean...
Yes, indeed. The world has known what you seem to consider your secret for a very long time.
That's impossible. I've gone through all the serious newspapers with a fine-tooth comb and haven't found the slightest hint of it.
The only place you can find the truth nowadays is in the scandal sheets, Mr. Hofer. They're chock full of my murders. Do you really suppose that the public would swallow my works if they didn't know that I only describe murders that I have committed?
But you'd have been arrested long ago if that were true.
Why?
Because you're a murderer, of course. A mass murderer.
Well, what of it? We writers have always been monsters, according to middle-class morality. I mean, look at Goethe, Balzac, Baudelaire, Verlaine, Rambo, Edgar Allan Poe. No matter how horrified the world was with us at first, it always wound up worshipping us more and more as time went on, precisely because we're monsters. We went up and up in the social scale until finally we were held in awe as superior beings. Society has not only accepted us, it has focused its interest almost exclusively on our private lives. We've become wish-fulfillment figures for the millions. Our art gives us carte blanche for our vices and our escapades. Do you really suppose I'd have been given the Nobel Prize for my novel The Murderer and the Child if I hadn't been the murderer myself? Look at these heaps of letters scattered round the room, from high society women, middle-class wives, from chambermaids, all of them offering themselves as sacrifices, victims of my future predations.
This is a nightmare.
From which it's high time you woke up. Only critics suppose that a writer sweats and slaves over literary form and dialogue. Real literature has nothing to do with literary matters. Its purpose is to satisfy the public. People soon tire of linguistic experiments or philosophical revelations. They no longer seek a life saturated in optimism, pregnant with hope, because they know that hope no longer exists. They yearn for a life brimming with tension, teeming with adventure, piquant with the pleasures of the moment, everything our machine-driven age can no longer offer. They look to find this in art. For them, literature has become a drug, a substitute for a way of life that is no longer possible. But in order to manufacture this drug, writers must lead the kind of life they describe. And believe me, that's one hell of a strain, particularly after one has reached a certain age. When I was young, I concentrated strictly on style. A few provincial publishers patted me on the back. Other than that, nobody gave a damn about me, and quite right. I gave up writing and wandered about, prospecting for oil in Persia, for example. I failed at that, too. That left me with only one thing to fall back on, to describe my own life. I thought I'd be arrested. The first person to congratulate me and give me an appreciable advance was the Swedish attaché with whose wife I had a tempestuous affair. The story of that affair became my first bestseller. Now, do have a glass of whiskey, since you've confessed such a weakness for it.
Thank you.
As soon as I realised what the world wanted, I set about supplying it with the desired commodity. I wrote only autobiography. I no longer paid any attention to style, and suddenly, hey presto, I was hailed as a stylist. I became famous, but my fame forced me to lead an ever more reckless life because my readers wanted to picture me in ever more horrifying situations so they could experience through me all that was forbidden. And that's how I became a mass murderer. From then on, everything that happened only increased my celebrity. My books were impounded and destroyed. The Vatican put me on their index. And the printings became more and more frequent. And now you show up. You, with your absurd evidence that my novels describe the truth. There isn't a judge or jury in the world that would pay you a moment's attention because, you see, the world wants me the way I am. They declare you insane, just as they've declared anyone else who's tried this. You think you're the first? Mothers, wives, husbands, sons have burst in on lawyers, lusting for revenge. Not a single lawsuit has been brought. District attorneys and ministers of justice, yes. Even presidents have intervened on my behalf in the name of art. Anyone who's tried to drag me before the courts has wound up looking extremely foolish. You're a fool, Mr. Hofer. You've thrown your savings away and demanded money from me. I have another reward in mind. Go on. Call for help.
For help?
I need a new plot.
What do you mean?
High time I got to work.
I'm going. I'm already on my way.
I should... pulled out this revolver to send you on your way, I took it out to kill you.
I swear to you, by all that's holy, that I'll leave immediately. I'll go straight back to Ennetville near Hawk.
You've given me an idea for a radio play, to be picked up as a subsequent screenplay, no doubt. See, I only write down what I have experienced, because, you see, I lack imagination, Mr. Hofer. So many will picture you standing before me the way you are now, trembling with fright, eyes staring, mouth open wide, a pitiful little clerk finally confronting the truth. Quite literally, in fact. Help! I don't see anyone rushing in. Are the movie star and the Archbishop of Chernovitz otherwise engaged?
You're the devil!
I am a writer and I need money. The radio play will be carried on all the networks. The film will be screened worldwide. Do you think I enjoy doing any of this? Actually, I'd much rather be having a glass of champagne with you down in the bar, followed by a nice dinner. Infinitely preferable to spending the night writing the account of your death.
Please, have mercy!
I'm afraid that in the literary profession, in the pursuit of truth, mercy is not included.
Help!
You are case number 23.
22! Mr. Corvis? What's happened, for heaven's sake?
My visitor has just left via the balcony, Sebastian, and is now, doubtless, mashed among the roses. Write that down.
Should I not call the manager?
I have every confidence the manager will already be giving the matter his full attention. I think a little whiskey and a cigar.
Sir. A light, sir.
Burn that list of names on the table. Tomorrow we'll pack. This place has served its purpose. Mallorca, I think.
Mallorca?
A little Mediterranean air will do us good. Now, a fresh page. Pen poised.
Ready, sir.
I consider it my duty, at the very outset, to describe to you the setting of this possibly somewhat peculiar, but I assure you, entirely true story. To be sure, there is a considerable element of danger in telling true stories. Someone from the police, or possibly even a high court judge, might be among those listening. Nonetheless, I can allow myself to take that risk, because I know perfectly well they won't believe my true story. At least, not in their official capacity. In reality, that is to say. So, imagine yourself in the drawing room of a suite at the Grand Hotel.
Different Truths comprise two short plays by Friedrich Dürrenmatt in versions for radio by Ian McDermid. The man was played by Ian McDermid, the other by Jim Broadbent, and the newsreader by Ian Dunnett Jr. In An Incident at Twilight, the author was played by Ian McDermid, the visitor by Michael Moreland, and Sebastian by Ian Dunnett Jr. Different Truths was a BBC Audio Scotland production, directed by Emma Harding, and produced by Gaynor McFarlane.
Oh. on BBC iPlayer.
You have few friends, Cromwell. Because of what you are, they don't know how to deal with you.
The conclusion of the BAFTA and Golden Globe winning series Wolf Hall.
The king never does an unpleasant thing. Lord Cromwell does it for him.
Starring Damian Lewis.
My patience is not infinite, neither with you nor my daughter.
And Mark Rylance.
When negotiation and compromise fail, and your only course is to destroy your enemy, before they wake in the morning, have the axe in your hand.
The new series of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, The Mirror and the Light. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
It's 9:10, and now on Radio 3, it's time to enjoy 20 minutes of music from some of our new generation artists. Each year, 6 or 7 fantastic musicians are given the opportunity to develop their skills in the concert hall, recording studio, and with the BBC orchestras. Many of them have gone on to great things like the pianist Paul Lewis and trumpet player Alison Balsam. First of all tonight, we're going to hear from the Leon Koro Quartet. They were formed in 2019 in Berlin, and the lineup includes 2 brothers, Jonathan and Lucas. They've toured all over the world and won many awards, and they're going to be playing a concert at the Wigmore Hall on Thursday night. Here they are with Purcell's Fantasia in F major. He wrote it in the summer of 1680, which was a bit of a mystery as this music wasn't really in fashion. It is possible that the fantasias he wrote at this time weren't even played in his lifetime, as so few of them survive in separate instrumental parts. So let's enjoy this one now from the Leon Koro Quartet.
Thank you.
New generation artist, the Leon Koro Quartet, with Purcell's Fantasia in F major on Radio 3. Next, to new generation artists, Santiago Cañón Falencia and Ulim Basimbayov. Santiago is a cellist from Colombia and is also a composer, photographer and painter. You might have heard him play as part of Radio 3 in concert at the Britain Studio in Snape on Wednesday night, along with Fergus MacCready, who we'll hear from before 9:30. If you missed it, you can listen again on BBC Sounds. Ulim won first prize in the Leeds International Piano Competition in 2021, and the summer before last you might have heard or seen him play Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 with the Sinfonia of London at the Proms. Here they are with Debussy's Bursoir, arranged for cello and piano. This was published in 1891 and was Debussy's last public collaboration with Paul Bourget, who had given up poetry for novel writing and criticism. We're not sure when it was composed, but let's enjoy this arrangement now from our two new generation artists.